This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
January 23rd, 2021. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. And I'm, as always, broadcasting from the very cold Chicago suburbs, but at least the sun is shining. I really appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org for people who can handle the truth. Please visit my website at spingola.com. The radio schedule page is on the left. Just click it to see the schedule. I no longer have a mailing list to notify the listeners of upcoming programs. During the program, email Deanna at spingola.email. Or ask your question in the chat room at spingola.chatango.com. Or call into the program at 800-313-9443 when we open the phone lines. I am kind of minimizing and making life a little bit easier. My computer was in the shop for 9 days. I lost all the addresses in my email client that I have used for several years. On Monday, I had to have a new furnace installed. This has not been a great week, but I viewed it as kind of a learning experience, and it reminded me of this story that I heard about a man, this is 5,000 years ago, about a gentleman, a family man, who felt that he was overburdened with problems, and he decided to go travel a distance and meet this very experienced sage. And the man concluded that he had 183 problems. And the sage listened to all of his problems, and then he said, "I can't help you." And the gentleman said, "He was just floored. He'd saved his money and traveled all this great distance." And the sage said, "You actually have 184 problems, because you think that you shouldn't have any problems." And so as I have experienced these, what were hardships for me, I looked around and I felt, okay, I have a home. I had the wherewithal to replace the furnace. I lost email addresses. So what? If people want to get a hold of me, they can now do that because my dear friend, my sweet good friend helped me to get my email back, because when I got my computer back, the old email client didn't work. All my contacts were there. All of them are gone. I only had a few, but I thought, okay, if people want to find me, if they want to give me their contact again, great. You know where I'm at. And the other sites too that I would like you to look at is SpingolaSpeaks.net. And this was put together by this wonderful friend whom I love dearly, who just he helped me out of the mess with setting up a brand new email program, which I am just learning. So anyway, if you want to use that email Deanna@Spingola.email during the program. That's cool. And anyway, love to my friend, love to all my friends. I'm happy you joined me today. My guest today is a very special person, and he's just such a terrific person, and we've known each other for quite some time, is Dave Gaheri. He is the co-author of Erasing the Liberty with Phil Turney and the producer of the full-length film about Israel's attack on the USS Liberty, which occurred on June 8th, 1967, which every politician that we have since then has not even mentioned it. And anyway, the websites are erasingtheliberty.com and USSLibertyMovie.com. Dave has a personal website, Dave Gaheri. That's GAHARY.com, DaveGaheri.com. And he also is a publisher of great... This man is amazing. He has TurningTheTidePublishing.com. And... I wrote a book back in 2015, called Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, and I talked about a book that I had read that I referenced, at least 11 times, and it was a gentleman by the name of John Verrappen. And, what an incredible person, that he was. And then Dave told me that he had republished the book, and I read it. I read the entire thing. He sent me a copy. I read it. I have so many post-it notes in here. If you only have one book that you want to read about Big Pharma, this is the one that you want to read. Everybody needs, whether you have interaction with Big Pharma, and everybody seems to have some sort of association with Big Pharma. Everybody needs to read this book. It is a must-read book. It's so wonderful. And Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Deanna, can you hear me okay?
I can.
All right. Well, thank you for that glowing introduction. I'm sure I'm not going to be able to live up to it, but yes, you're right. It is an important book, and it's sad that the author left us too soon.
Indeed. But not before you worked with him and got so much more out of, there was the original book, but you
right,
expanded.
Because you read both. Right.
Yes, yes. And it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, I was thinking about the show, and it's sad because John was such a, like a fireball of energy. He really was. And even with his medical issues, primarily because he was diabetic, he had a lot of problems health-wise. And he just had this energy that he wasn't giving up. And just like he didn't give up with getting me involved with his mission. And then before the book was even released, the second edition, that's when I got, well, I actually dug for the news. If you don't mind, I'd like to actually read a bit from the book to...
Oh, please. Oh my gosh, yes, please. Oh,
great, yeah, to bring the listeners up to speed. And I wrote the foreword, and it's titled The Pill-Pushing Racket. And, of course, our good friend Paul from over at TBR, he he did the typesetting for this and the cover, and he's just terrific, Paul. I'll start. It says, I ran into John Virapin's work several years ago. He sent me his books, and we eventually set up an interview to discuss the book you're holding in your hands now, an extremely important book on the massive pharmaceutical industry and its questionable strategies. I told John the book read like a novel, where you grow attached to the protagonist, but coupled with the shocking revelations he brought forth, was much more than that. Full-length feature film is what I was thinking. John was born on February 4, 1943. So you could see he, in a few years, if he was still alive, he would be 80.
Wow.
And I was surprised to find out this was his first book, for his writing style was seasoned. He did the audio interview and he graciously agreed to tell the same tale he had been telling for years. Big Pharma is not simply satisfied with hooking adults with their drugs, but now they're after our children too. Short time after that, John asked if I would work as his agent for his books, as he felt that I would be able to introduce them to a larger audience. I politely declined several times, due mostly to time constraints, but John was persistent, as John was, and he won out. Maybe he knew his time was short on this earth, and he wanted his life's work handed off to someone he trusted. I can't say for sure. We spent many hours on Skype going over every page in this book for clarification and elaboration, and we had the last chapter left in early April 2015. We scheduled the next day to complete it, and when he didn't show up on Skype, I knew something was wrong. John was always online, and he kept his appointments. I eventually, with great effort, tracked him down at a local hospital in Sweden, where he was drugged up terribly and could barely speak. Fortunately, some of the staff filled me in, and there was a release date, which was good. He got out of the hospital and was home for a while. I spoke with him a few more times, and he gave me his usual pep talk about all we were going to do to expose the global pharmaceutical industry. He was rushed back to the hospital a short time later. Unfortunately, he was not destined to return home. On April 27, 2015, I tried him again on Skype through a text message, and a call came in. I was relieved, but I still had that feeling in the pit of my stomach. It wasn't John, but his son, Stanley, who gave me the bad news. The day before, John had succumbed to his near-lifelong battle with diabetes. Although I had expected to hear something like this, I was still floored. Stanley and I spoke for a while about his dad and his dad's wishes, and we decided to pick up where John Virapin left off, not letting his work die, but breathing new life into it, to warn future generations of the addictions that Big Pharma hopes to rack up. For the fact is that today the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world are not interested in curing disease, but convincing everyone, young and old alike, they are sick. Sick from something, it doesn't matter what, and that their expensive pills will solve whatever ailment they have, real or imagined. But the kicker is that many of the addictive pills they are pushing have long lists of side effects that are much worse than any disease itself. Big Pharma is even in the business of inventing diseases to create new markets for even more pills, as shown by John's revelations on what is today called attention deficit disorder. Doing this work without John isn't easy, but it's the least we could do for a man who gave us so much. That's it.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, he was something else. And, you know, just like I said, full of energy and just ready to go and ready to get out. And he could speak well. And, you know, his background is also fascinating. And I'd like to, after the break, start with that, actually. Just so, again, the listeners can get an idea of the man and where he came from and, you know, how far he went, actually, and what he gave up to reveal what he knew. And I just want to say that I appreciate your interest in this and kind words about it, because writing the book, Screening Sandy Hook, obviously you did tons of research into these drugs. And to say what you did about this book is, it's a great thing, because obviously you know the material well, so thank you.
It is just amazing, and you brought up his entire history, which is so amazing that he went from what he did, his Catholicism, how it added to his personality, how everything that occurred to him, and did occur to him, and the predicament that certain religious people placed his family in, and it all lent to what he learned to do, how he learned to manipulate circumstances, and also the sacrifices that he gave up, or the sacrifices that he made, just to stay alive at certain times in his life. And it was just, and the circumstances around him meeting his first wife, it is an incredible story, and one that you want to really, you don't want to miss a thing. You don't want to skip around in this book. You can't skip around in this book.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, for me anyway, I never skip around in books, but you know, I need to read everything in a book. And I know a lot of people are kind of, you know, put off or maybe intimidated by longer books, but the way that I look at books personally is that it doesn't really matter how many pages they are, because that's why you picked up the book. Whether they're, it's 192 or 4 pages like this one, which isn't that many pages relatively, or it's 800 pages, which, you know, recently I completed a book that was just about that. And it takes a while, but I mean, you have that knowledge, and that's the great thing about books, is that obviously the people who spent the time putting them together, you can gain all of that knowledge from all of the hours and days and weeks and months and years that they spent compiling it. So yeah, it is a very important book, and it's really one of these books that is, of course, it would never be promoted by by the mainstream, because that's how they make their living, is off of advertising from Big Pharma, which has been revealed by many people, but most, I guess, poignantly by Robert Kennedy Jr., who met with that. I know you know about this. He met with that TV executive, and then he said, "There's just no way we can't say anything negative about him." And of course, I'm paraphrasing, because they pay the bills. So that's why, I guess, if you watch television, which again I don't, but if you watch television, every ad or every other ad is for a Big Pharma drug, which is, it's just weird. Everything's really weird now, I think, you know, like not just the political environment that we find ourselves in, but even just if you turned on the TV, let's say, you know, 50 years ago and turned it on today, it's like a completely different world.
Indeed. And yet they started the pattern years ago, with promoting, there were doctor shows, a lot of doctor shows, and the doctors always were brilliant, and they always cured everything, and it gave you a trust in the medical industry that we now find that many people, the minute they have something wrong, they run to their doctor. Okay, we're going to a break. We'll be right back momentarily.
starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Dave Gaheri. He is the co-author of Erasing Liberty. But we're talking about today is a fabulous book called Side Effects, Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. And just before the break, we were talking about television. And I used to leave it on in the background. I would be working, writing, researching, and it'd be on in the background just because, just to have some noise in the house. But I did take note of all these commercials and how many there were, and noted how brainwashing they were. And even if you have something on in the background, it's affecting your mind. Your mind is taking it in. You might not be you're not doing it consciously. So I decided, well, almost a year ago, to unplug the TV and not ever turn it on again, which I haven't turned it on for almost a year. And there are some people who actually leave their TVs on all night and think, oh my gosh, they're being brainwashed at night. They don't even realize it. So that's just my thoughts about.
No, that's exactly right. It's, you know, obviously they, I mean, I know family members who do it. I'm not going to implicate which ones, but yeah, it's, you know, and you would think that the ears, you know, the entire body would want a break from the constant sound and the sounds and the, you know, the video. And but some people, I guess they feel more comfortable with that on even at night while they're sleeping. But yes, I could see how, well, obviously it's done a, they've done a fantastic job in brainwashing, you know, millions of people, obviously, in this country.
Right.
Around the world.
And it's ongoing on what is going on currently with the COVID situation.
Absolutely. Yes.
COVID creation.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, everything's moving in lockstep with that. And, you know, and I've personally thought about the, and I've gotten really frustrated with, you know, what is known as the mainstream media. And I think it's probably accurate to continue calling it the mainstream media because, unfortunately, there's so many people who think, you know, if it's on TV, it's got to be true. But but our ranks are growing, clearly. And I think it's really important not to focus on the mainstream media, but to focus on our media.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, like that commercial that, you know, I think it was News with Views or something. I can't remember, but where they see that
with
guy.
With the birdcage?
What was it?
To use the paper for the birds.
Yeah.
How appropriate for, especially if you have a large parrot. That should definitely, that is the way that we should feel about, the so-called, mainstream press and, and of course, TV and or radio.
Right.
I have come to appreciate Republic Broadcasting so much, because they have been around, for a long time. We have witnessed other radio stations going out of business, and bless John's heart, he continues to, even despite personal problems, he continues to produce a radio program. And speaking of producers, the producer that takes care of this program is just terrific. He he has wonderful opinions and interacts. It's just, I couldn't ask for a better opportunity. And yes. Somebody said, well, gosh, you've been doing this for a while. And a friend of mine said, you know, kind of encouraged me to quit. And I thought, no, I got to keep my finger in the pie. I've got this. When I take my last breath, it's when I'll quit.
Yeah, there's no reason to quit. Why? I mean, as long as you could do it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You have an audience. You have, you know, you're seasoned. You know, you have a vast store of knowledge. You're an excellent researcher, an excellent writer. To step back from this would, you know, really be a blow to, you know, those in our small, you know, small but effective arena. I think, you know, I was talking to somebody on Skype and, I said that, you know, he said, hey, we haven't spoken in a while.
Okay. We'll pick this up on the other side. We'll be right back.
What's with you and me? It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, we are back. And our guest is Dave Gehary. And we are talking about a book titled Side Effects, Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. And, John, you pronounce it Verapin?
John Verapin. And, of course, that's not his full name, but...
right. Yes, you know, okay.
A real long name. But I was saying before the break that this colleague said to me that, hey, we haven't, you know, touched base in a while, and I'm paraphrasing here, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He says, can you believe what's happening, basically? He said, I saw it for what it really was all along. I still find it hard to believe it has all worked so easily for them. And of course he's talking about COVID and the
right.
election and all that. I said, I agree. And I think many feel the same. I said, look, there's good news. We're more united than ever and good things are happening. The more they push, the stronger we get like a muscle. And it's true. So now is really an exciting time for us, I think, because they have really pushed so hard, and they're continuing to push with their banning and censorship and deleting, that there's so many more people now coming over to, if we want to say, our side. People who, someone was telling me that folks who, you know, do videos on, let's say, YouTube or BitChute or whatever it might be about, let's say, movies or science fiction stories, where they generally shied away or just steered clear of these type of topics, you know, politics or culture or whatever, in regards to politics, now they're not. Now they've become active. So I think it's a great time for us, and I think it had to happen this way, although none of us could predict that it would have, but I think we're going to start really impacting a lot more people on a much greater scale.
I really hope so. There seems to be so many, well, people are making a lot of videos, as you mentioned. And you know it's a good video if you get a warning that you're going to an unsafe website. And those are the videos you want to ignore that message and go there anyway. Because they are attempting to censor on Twitter and and Facebook and all the social media. Now, I've never been active in Facebook, but I have recently become active in Twitter. And my gosh, there are people that lose maybe 2,000 followers in a day. And, or they're banned. I was sent to the censorship corner, for posting something. I couldn't post anything for 12 hours. And, I interviewed, a couple weeks ago, another individual whose book you published, and, Angelo John Gage. And, he's always being censored. He was sent to the corner, for 12 hours. So,
yes.
And it's very apparent, to the followers, and so they think, oh, well, maybe we better go to some other site, or maybe create another site. But so many of these sites are just, options that are also under the control of the powers that be. But people are recognizing that. They are recognizing that we must keep fighting. Because when you're censored or when you're limited in the people that you can speak with or to, it makes you want to spread the word better and bigger and not give up.
Yes, that's right. And Angelo was just... I was the same with you, Facebook. I rarely used it, and I only got into it because I wanted to contact that band member from Pink Floyd to do an interview with him.
Oh!
I can't remember the guy's name, but at any rate, that was why I did it, and I was... I almost got him as a guest, which was pretty cool. I was pretty close, but I wasn't able to do Roger Waters. That's his name.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was that, I had a Facebook account, which I rarely used, but they actually disabled my account a few months ago. And I mean, you hear about these stories of, you know, they call it Facebook jail.
Right.
Yeah, and I had never been to Facebook jail because I had never, I guess, violated whatever it is that you can't violate. And but that didn't matter. They just took me out.
Well, they did the same thing with Angelo. He hardly ever used it, and he went to use it, and it wasn't there anymore.
Exactly. That's right. He just told me they just took him out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they, like you said, they banned him or put him on, you know, on ice for 12 hours. And I've never used this Twitter, and I probably never will. I really dislike all of these clowns. But I think that's what I was saying. I think that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and there are now more options to do what has to be done, you know, all the way from shortwave radio, you know, to, you know, one of these new social media, you know, interfaces like Gab or Telegram or, you know, Signal or whatever it might be. And people are waking up and they're doing it. So, yeah, I feel pretty positive about people waking up, and usually I don't, but I think we're in a sweet spot.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, I think it is. So let me read this, if I may, about John.
Yes, please.
And I'm just reading a little bit, because obviously we want folks to pick up the book and
absolutely
read it for themselves. And we may have briefly mentioned it, but of course you may have briefly mentioned it, and myself as well, that you had read this book for as part of your research for screening mm-hmm. Sandy Hook. And of course that was the first edition, which wasn't called the first edition, or at least not prominently.
Right.
And that edition obviously became the second edition after John and I went through it. And that's what I was saying when I was reading it, I was shocked that that was the first thing he ever wrote, because, besides, you know, writing is kind of tough to do. But his background, you know, I mean, just coming from
incredible.
Where he did.
Incredible.
Yeah, incredible.
It was incredible.
Incredible.
What he started out as.
Yes.
In Guyana.
Right.
What he became.
That's right.
Was absolutely mind-boggling.
Exactly. This is chapter one. I'm just going to read a little bit from it just to give folks an idea of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the chapter is titled How I Became What I Am. And he says, I turned 72 in February. If you were to see a photo of me, you'd never believe that I am Swedish, but it's written under the heading nationality on my passport. I speak fluent Swedish, although it isn't my native language. I was born in British Guiana. Since 1966, called Guyana, a country which in many respects is the absolute opposite of Sweden. I'm the father of an 11-year-old son. He is a pride of my old age. At the same time, I'm very worried about him when I think about his future and the dangers that lurk, dangers with which I was involved. I'm just gonna be a little quieter in here, soundproof it. I believe no one is unscrupulous by nature, including me. It is unforgivable that I let myself be roped into the dirty dealings of Big Pharma without saying no, or even just protesting, indeed, without even getting upset. But maybe it's not all that unexplainable. My childhood followed the same pattern, the pattern of power and its abuse. My memories of childhood and adolescence are not meant to cleanse me. Biography is not an excuse, but it can help to explain why I walked right into the traps that had been set up for me and why I found it so difficult to free myself again. And the next heading says, growing up in British Guiana. I was born in a small village in British Guiana, which at that time, as the name reveals, was a British colony. My skin is dark. I am of Indian descent, although British Guiana lies on the north coast of South America. My great-grandparents came as coolies, and that's C-O-O-L-I-E-S, laborers to South America, recruited as voluntary slaves. The New World was portrayed to them in the brightest colors, and they were promised the life of a free and wealthy person, at least after they had paid back the costs for the crossing, for which they naturally didn't have the money. So yeah, this guy came from, you know, beyond a modest background, almost in slavery, you know, the coolies, and you know, I think that's a, you know, somewhat of a common term, but you know, the coolies were basically slaves, and
right.
they had to do what their masters told them they should do, but they could buy themselves out of slavery. But of course, like most anything, it's very difficult to really get a leg up and you know, achieve, you know, the goal of becoming independent, you know, especially financially, because, you know, in many ways the deck is rigged against most people. That's not saying that you cannot break out of, you know, that financial trap that might appear that way to many. And it is, it's difficult, for many people. And many people don't really have a high regard for money, and others have a great regard for it. But this guy was, you know, really nothing more than a slave, the child of slaves. And here he is going to the, really the top of the, you know, the heap.
Right.
And becoming one of the most influential, representatives and promoters of big pharma to the, you know, all the way to the point of it was John who was, and folks will understand this when they read the book, it was John who was solely responsible, almost solely responsible, I guess you could say solely, for the approval of Prozac.
Right.
Was the first really drug in that category to become a blockbuster. And, you know, since that time, of course, we have all these, is it psychotropic? Is that the right term, Deanna?
Yes. SSRIs.
That are, you know, all the rage.
Selective serotonin.
Yes, right.
Release inhibitors. It is totally amazing. And when you first told me about the book, I looked it up on Amazon to see what the price was. It was like $247 or something. And I thought, see, they don't want anybody to read it. It was the original book. And if they don't want you to read something, they outprice it, or they simply censor it, take it off of Amazon or other websites. But this edition is readily available. And when I was reading about his background, it brought to mind other people, other politicians who engaged in the slave trade, including notable people like Herbert Hoover, who was a politician, who became president. He was the Secretary of Commerce for a while. And he was doing a lot of trading. He sent 200,000 Chinese to work in the mines in Africa by promising them good food and a good environment and all these wonderful things. And literally they were just dying in the mines, which they would have to go deep into the earth. And so when you look at the slave trade as the entire operation from many angles, you see that these people have an early death, and they're worked to death, and they never amount to anything. They never amount. Many of them die because of the abusive treatment. And to think that he was a slave, literally, he was a slave, and his family were slaves. And to become what he became is it boggles the mind just to think about it. And obviously he was incredibly intelligent, and he, because of his background, because of his dealings with the Catholic Church and some of the experiences that I hope you'll talk about, he learned to become a survivor in an environment that was meant to do him in.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He was, you know, one of these people who... Oh, here we go.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side of the break. Right back. All right, welcome back. Our guest is Dave Gaheri, and he is the publisher, TurningTheTidePublishing.com, and some of the other offerings are just fabulous. Just fabulous books that I've read, and this latest film you've come out with, but we'll talk about that later. Anyway, and yes. you're subbing for me next week,
yes.
I'm just so delighted with what you're doing.
Well, thanks.
You are so impressive. Okay.
Oh, come on. Hold on. Let me tell my wife that. I'll be right back. I'll get a dose of reality.
And have her Skype me a Reuben.
What's that?
Have her Skype me a Reuben.
Yes, she'll tell you how fabulous I am. But no, I really appreciate that, and it really is it really is a team effort. I guess when you're younger, a lot of people don't realize that. You know, they think that they could do all this stuff on their own, and you know, it's me against the world. And but it really is a team effort, and it feels a lot better to work with a team. The stuff that we do in the publishing arena couldn't be done without all the team members. You know, it's right. not just, you know, it's not just me doing it, obviously. It's a bunch of people, and it's great that there is that much talent there that can come together and produce the kind of stuff that's produced, because it's all about producing, of course. And I sent you a link, and of course you're very familiar with this. We just started carrying, not at Turning the Tide Publishing, but at Money Tree Publishing.
Yes.
The DVD, The Greatest Story Never Told.
Yes.
And that's been banned, obviously. And
oh, sent. I know. Imagine that.
And so Dennis and a colleague of his reached out to me in August when the outlet that they had was not taken down, but it was just not functioning anymore. And we just actually got it up and running last night. So it took that long because there was a lot of research going into it and how it was going to be done. But if folks go to, and Side Effects Death used to be at MoneyTreePublishing.com, but Money Tree Publishing is more for, the niche of, items like this particular four box set DVD, The Greatest Story Never Told. They can go to MoneyTreePublishing.com and check that out. So there's a lot of people who are interested in this fella, Adolf Hitler, because so much time and energy and money is spent by the powers who should not be on demonizing this guy. I think a lot of people just sense that, just as you were saying, when they have that little warning, sealed for your protection notice on
right.
the YouTube videos. That's why you want to go in there and see what they're protecting you from. Yeah, because they care about us so much.
Right.
So,
All righty, we're at the top of the hour. Yeah, they care about us so much. They want to protect us. Be right back.
Network, because you can handle the truth.
All righty, welcome back. Our guest is Dick Harry, and we were talking about another project that he has recently completed that's available, and I did post the link in the chat room, and I had been thinking a lot about Dennis Wise in the last few weeks, and I had attempted to get a hold. Well, I sent it maybe 2 months ago, and then a month ago I emailed him, and I never heard back, and I thought, oh gosh, I hope he's okay. He's such a courageous person, and did such a fabulous job, and the research behind it were
yes,
just
yes. He's okay. He was just he had some health issues, which you know are I think resolved now. So
good.
Yeah, he is well respected in this community, and he put together a wonderful piece that. That's been viewed many, many times around the world.
Monumental.
And now, of course, it has a home. And from the first introduction to it last night, we've been getting quite the response. So it's really good. But what I was saying about John was that he's one of these guys who, and not just limited to men, of course, one of these people who can or has pulled themselves up, as they say, by their own bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great imagery, right? I mean, you're on the ground and you pull yourself up right from the ground. That's exactly what he did. And I think, and I've said this before, and I think on your show too, that's one of the great things about this country is that you really can do almost anything that you set your mind to.
Or even in Sweden or Guyana or just.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think this country represents that spirit of, I guess, entrepreneurship or independence, mm-hmm. freedom, to be able to even think about the things. I think that's the first step, right? Thinking mm-hmm. about doing something. You know, I think I can, right? I think I can do it. And mm-hmm. and then having the opportunity to do it, which of course he did, and he made his mark. And I think besides the literary appeal of this book, I think it's important because of, and I'm sure this is what you wanted to touch upon as well. It's important because of what they're trying to do. And when I say there, we're talking, of course, the establishment class, the people who are in the driver's seat and sitting in that vehicle that they're in and, you know, moving forward, propelling forward the mass media, the government, all of the institutions that benefit from this COVID vaccine or these COVID vaccines, this modus operandi of getting this done was not as obviously centralized and sophisticated as it is now, because there's a lot more at stake for them. But when John was involved in Big Pharma, they were using similar tactics and, from cajoling to flat out bribery, which is what he did to get the job done and get these drugs approved, go to the health authorities of these particular countries and bribe the person in charge to do what had to be done in order to get the drug approved. So I think it's important in the sense that folks need to know what they're up against, who they're up against, and,
yes.
And this will give them, I think, the ammunition necessary to take on or to mentally understand what they're dealing with.
Oh, this book, if everybody read this book, they would know exactly they would know the enemy. They could recognize immediately the enemy that's before them, and they would be able to defend themselves against that enemy. And, it is just, people really do not understand how this whole thing worked and how incremental it was that you just, that, John just started out. Gosh, he started out, when you read his history, eating out of garbage cans, being homeless, walking barefoot, and then to realize that he achieved a PhD and that he had so much power and his intuitiveness on how to manipulate people the way that he had been manipulated as a child. No lesson was lost on him. He learned how to do this. His life experiences taught him to be a survivor, even if it meant doing things that, well, he was a survivor. He was a survivor in his elected position with Big Pharma. He knew how to work people incredibly well. He was a master manipulator because he learned how to manipulate as a little 5-year-old, a little 3-year-old. And he never forgot those lessons. They were ingrained in him to the point that he, like Sidney Durrell, oh gosh, what a piece of garbage that guy was.
Who's that?
Durrell, the guy that,
Oh yes, 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 yes.
And it was just, this book is mind-boggling. Everybody needs to read it. Honestly, everybody needs to read this book.
Yes. It's kind of the, I don't want to use the word Bible.
It's the Bible.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. It's kind of the Bible of Big Pharma. That here's a guy who went all the way to the top. And that's what I was saying. It really is, it's such an underused asset that you would think that it would not be the case, but it is that, you know, more people need to know about it. And yes, you know, we don't, you know, obviously, or no, we don't have the budget to, you know, get the news out to everybody, of course. Like they do, and you know, people are, you know, sometimes coming across it and you know, going to turningthetidepublishing.com, and I think actually someone from one of your listeners just got it not too long ago, maybe like a half hour ago or something.
Good.
Or less.
I think all of my listeners should do that.
Yes.
It's a must read. Honestly, it's just a must read. And as I mentioned, I probably have 100 post-it notes in here because there's so many important things.
If you want to go over some stuff.
Oh my gosh! Just let's see. The thing that was so impressive to me was, and it's not. It is his early life and his interaction with the church, because that was his first experience, other than his family experience of being coolies. This was his independent personal experience with being manipulated as a little more than a toddler. Oh, that made me sick.
Yes.
But he was, it developed his appreciation for family. It developed an appreciation for, he was 3. His father became seriously ill when he was 3. And, his father was a fisherman. And how these children, his older brother stepped in and took over the business. his mother would take the fish to the market every day, and there were seven children, two girls, five boys, and he was the second to last in the lineup. So he learned early on how to survive, watching how his family worked together to survive, and then he survived his own interpersonal relationship. I don't want to even call it a relationship. He survived a decadent assault on him. And he learned that sometimes you do what you have to do in order to make sure that your family got fed.
Yes. Yes, that's a nice way to sum it up. And of course, what was done to him was disgusting.
Yes.
Yeah. And it happens to, obviously it happens to a lot of people.
Yes.
You know, in different circumstances, and some of them worse than others. But yeah, he's an incredible, you know, that, and I wanted to say that before. I procrastinate on some things, most things. And I've discovered over the years that procrastinating actually has been beneficial for me, except in one area. And that area is when someone dies. So, you know, where I said, geez, I wanted to see this person again, or I wanted to talk to them. But I really wish that he was around to see this, what was done, because when I read the book, the first one, I actually went over every line. So we went over everything, and just to make sure that it was right, or just to get, as I said, you know, amplification on it, or if there were errors to correct them. But there was stuff in, as you saw, Deanna, there was stuff in the second edition that wasn't in the first, and
right.
and it was more fleshed out, and I think that makes it a lot better book. And the upshot of it is that really the people who are operating this machine called Big Pharma are evil, and they don't care how many people die from what they're hawking. You know, like we see with the vaccines, people are dying. Hank Aaron might have died.
Right.
From the vaccine. I mean, he was a hero, you know, of mine and people in my age group growing up. I mean, a lot of these baseball players, for me, no more. I'm like you. I haven't watched TV since 1991, and I certainly would not watch, you know, sports, that anti-American, you know, entity, that's run by, you know, the members of the tribe primarily. I'm not interested in hearing that crap. I'm not interested in hearing about is systemic racism or white supremacy. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're in this arena. I don't know any white supremacists. I don't know, you know, what is that anyway? I mean,
right.
The way that this media is going after, that, you know, the whites now, it's getting to the point where I think, you know, enough white people are going to take notice and realize that they don't know any white supremacists, and that's really not an issue. And the media is trying to create this problem, and, you know, the whole white privilege nonsense and all that. I mean, this is not good. This is not a good thing that's happening, but, we can be fairly certain to say that the people who are running Big Pharma are more interested in getting people hooked. I mean, just look at the Sackler family, what they did with OxyContin.
Oh, yes.
They made, well, you know, they made billions, I mean, hundreds of thousands of Americans, many who were just looking for pain relief and got addicted, have died. They've destroyed the lives of perhaps millions of people, and they're still incredibly wealthy. And the system, the capitalist system, allows, and the judicial system allows this type of thing to happen. And when more and more people begin dying, and when it's uncovered that perhaps Hank Aaron was one of them from this vaccine that they have not tested, we could find all this. We can find the beginnings of what we're seeing now in the book, Side Effects Death.
Absolutely. Right. And they make so much money on the drug itself that they allow enough money for lawsuits. And even if there is a lawsuit, they will buy off judges. They will buy off the witnesses. They will buy people off. Because they make so much money that a lawsuit is insignificant, especially right. When they can affect the outcome.
That's right, and it's the cost of doing business. You know, the proverbial cost of doing business. It's like, you know, the automobile industry, same thing. I mean, they calculate, and everything nowadays is, you know, people think they have an image of, you know, for example, let's say President Trump, you know, going into a meeting to decide something. They don't realize that there's probably as many or more lawyers in the room who are supposedly vetting everything and, you know, clearing it than there are policymakers. I mean, lawyers basically control everything now, I think.
Right.
And if someone just looks at, for example, you brought up that wonderful human being, Sidney Turrell, if somebody, you know, when they get the book, they'll get to this point, obviously, where they talk about the Prozac. John explains how it was that, well, it's name is fluoxetine, right? Is that how you say it, Deanna?
Right. And it has fluoride in it. Well, water has fluoride in it.
Why not?
Yeah, sure. Throw some fluoride in it.
Right.
They tested it. When you look at the test and the number of people that participated in the test was something like 286. And keep in mind that when drug companies approach the FDA, the FDA does no testing whatsoever. The FDA was created in 1906 in order to protect corporations. And what they do is that the drug company itself does these clinical, clinical trials, quote unquote. And they weed out the people who are suicidal and all that. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, we are back with our guest, Dave Gehry, and we were talking about Prozac and how it was approved. There were 286 people, or maybe it's 287 people, that actually participated in the trial, the clinical trial. However, there were people in the clinical trial who committed suicide, so of course their numbers weren't counted. But when you consider, the buildup for this product and the wide dissemination of this product, the real guinea pigs are people who opted to take this product. And the other thing that is so horrible about it is you can do off-label prescriptions. In other words, it can be prescribed for just about anything that any doctor can think of prescribing it for. If you go in with a cuticle or, you know, you've got an ingrown toenail, oh, give them some Prozac. And so.
Yes. Off-label marketing, they make billions off of that. That's right.
Yes. And
it was children, 286, Deanna, you were right. It was 286.
Right.
Which is really a slap in the face.
It is.
I mean, so yeah, what's great about it is, you know, reading this was that you learn really how rigged it is, against us and how they just, I guess it's indicative of now with what's happening, that people look at this and they see this really runaway locomotive here where they're just having their way. And, you know, regardless of what any of us is saying, anybody's saying, they're, you know, other professionals, doctors with, you know, experience, decades of experience, and they're just banning them, deleting them, censoring them, and they just don't care. That's why, you know, logically, this can't go on like this. There's gonna be a point where, you know, your person in the street finally gets it and says, no, you can't be doing this. You know, big tech and big media and big government and whoever else, you know, obviously the intelligence agencies are involved, and of course. We discussed briefly that just really a few days ago was the 60th anniversary of Eisenhower's address, his farewell address, you know, 3 days before Kennedy was set to be sworn in, the military-industrial complex speech, which of course is ironic on many fronts, but, you know, nonetheless, it was important because he went, as president, he went to the American people to warn them about this complex that had grown around him. And of course he had, as you said, he had a lot to do with that. But nonetheless, he's telling them, you have to do something about this. And it's only gotten infinitely and exponentially worse to the point where we are almost in Skynet territory, where, you know, the intelligence agencies are reading everything that we create, whether it's in email or our phone calls or this show or, you know, the USPS going through the mail, which I've been getting more reports recently that mail has been looked into.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, and of course now this particular administration wants to go after the white supremacists, the domestic extremists. I guess if you were one of the founding fathers now, you would be obviously a domestic extremist. And, you know, forget about, you know, patriotism or the Constitution or wanting the country to, you know, follow in the footsteps of what these geniuses put together. No, if you want that, you are a threat to the machine and you will be taken out.
It's not good.
But like I said, I'm hopeful that things are going to change, because the more they push us, you know, the more our muscles grow.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, I think it is, because, you know, obviously what Nietzsche said, you know, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. You know, that's kind of a variation on that. And people are pushed now. A lot of people are really, I think that, a lot of people, one word that could be used to describe a lot of people is exasperated. They're just like, they can't believe it. They can't believe that what happened, but they're going to wake up out of it, that, you know, fog, and they're going to strike back. But I wanted to, if we have time, just touch on how it is that John was pressured into handling the Prozac matter. Do we have a little time?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, well, let's see. We're scheduled for a break momentarily, and then we're going to have 20 minutes after.
Okay. Yes. So then probably it might make sense to wait for that. It's going to take a little time to go, but I'll set it up that, you know, here you have this particular drug that they put into the pipeline and they had big plans for. And the next step was, well, how are we going to get this drug moving? How are we going to get it approved? Because there are hurdles for the approval. And that's when somebody like Sidney Taurel comes into the picture as the CEO of Eli Lilly and uses the weight of that position to motivate an underling, in this case John, to do the dirty work that he was not going to do. And John explains, and this is really, you know, one of the best parts of the book, although there are so many great parts in the book, but how it happened that Taurel used his position to get John to do what had to be done in order to get Prozac approved, and then people obviously addicted to it and doctors prescribing it and creating that vicious circle of bribery and all of the other parts to the puzzle, and what John did in order to zero in on the individual that would actually open the door for Prozac to be prescribed to now millions of people. And, you know, and that's what really bothered John, was that they were going after the kids. And when you think about the number of children who are on these mind-altering drugs, when in the past, when we were growing up, you wouldn't even think about it. You know, okay, there might have been a kid who, you know, was a little more hyper than the other kids. Well, you don't deal with it by cramming a drug down their throats.
No.
Deal with it with other ways. But then again, there's been an entire industry whose main focus has been destroying the nuclear family. And we know all about them, and we know who they are. And, you know,
including
this, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Including the federal control of the school system, which has a lot to do with teachers now being qualified, quote unquote, to say, oh, your child needs to be on Ritalin, or your child needs this, or your child needs that.
Or we're going to take them away.
Yes. Yes. So
yes,
parents are backed into a corner.
It really is a nightmare right now, the position that we've been put in. And that's why I think a lot of people want to drop or get off of the grid, you know, drop off of, you know, this connection that most of us have to, you know, the federal government or the state governments or, the corporations. Really, the corporations now are, and I guess they always have, right? They've always run the show. It's just becoming painfully obvious now as they move in lockstep, you know, what their priorities are. And it's certainly not us, right?
No. And that's been true since the so-called end of the end of the so-called Civil War, is that corporations were allowed to exercise the rights of an individual, and so they were free to adopt those rights, and we became a corporatocracy, and they altered the 13th Amendment. For one thing, lawyers were never supposed to serve in Congress, and you go all the way back. You mentioned the Constitution. You mentioned capitalism versus communism. They were both created by the Rothschild clan. It was called the European plan, and they created both systems. So there was And that has been the case.
Yes. Yes, and you've written books on this. So, I mean, that's why I'm sitting here talking about this one book, but here you are with, you know, really this vast store of knowledge. It's kind of funny that, you know, you're interviewing me. I should be interviewing you.
Well, this book is compared to mine, a very easy read. There's no excuse for no one to not read this book. People can look at my books and say, I don't want to read a 700-page book, but they can look at this book and say, hey, this is something I can do.
Yeah.
This is something that I can do and sink my teeth in and have knowledge for what is going on right now. This is a right now book.
That's
it's
right.
Current to what is going on, more than any book that I have, read, and I read all the time. I have three or four books a week. But.
Wow.
This book is a must read book. Well, you just keep publishing stuff.
Yeah.
That's your expertise is, and the editing and the talking with people, and you were able to work with what was available, and you created a masterpiece.
Oh, come on. Well, thank you very much. And that's, that means so much to me, you saying that. And I guess the other part of it is that we, you know, not just publish, but we also fulfill. And so, one of the things we pride ourselves on is getting the books out immediately. So, any books that are ordered over the weekend always go out as long as it's not a holiday on Monday. And if they're ordered, on Monday early enough, they go out on Monday, and same for all the other days. So we get them out right away, and we like to get them in the hands of the buyers right away. Of course, the USPS doesn't accommodate, but they're getting better, actually.
Right.
You know, it was a tough time with the election, with this Operation COVID, and with you know, the mail-in ballots and the holidays, that there were books that and DVDs that, you know, took literally, it's fine. One customer had contacted me, ordered, you know, a DVD of Hellstorm. And he ordered it, I think, on December 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shipped right away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was delivered yesterday. So, and I'm talking to the United States. No, December 4th. So it was shipped. He ordered it on December 4th. It was shipped on December 4th. The next update from December 4th was January 20th, where it arrived in Detroit.
Oh my God.
So it went from here, Crestview, Florida, to Detroit, Michigan, December 4th to January 20th.
Oh my gosh.
So in the meantime, you know, we sent him out, you know, another one, and said that, you know, hey, if it gets there, just keep it, you know, which it did. And
sure,
he said,
yeah,
would you like me to send it back? I said, no, of course not. So we send it out right away. But the problem is that the USPS is, or was, let's hope they're going to improve. And they're getting a rate hike that goes into effect tomorrow, unfortunately. So, you know, media mail is increasing, because I saw that actually today. So something that would cost $5 to ship media mail is now $5.18, because they tacked on an additional, I think it's 9 cents per pound, for media mail, and an additional ounce stamp, which was 15 cents, is going up to 20 cents. So it's affecting a lot of things. And just know that we get this stuff out right away. And if you order Side Effects Death today, we'll get it out Monday. It'll be in the mail, and then you can receive, if you get it online, of course, with an email, you'll receive, as soon as the label's created, an email with the tracking information. And make sure you check your junk and spam, because for some reason it ends up there a lot. And besides credit and debit cards, we also accept cash, check, money orders, and cryptocurrency. So cryptocurrency's been on a tear lately. If you look at Bitcoin, it went up to, I think, over 40,000, you know, recently, wow. Which is, it's crazy. Right now it's at 30-something thousand, 32,000, but I think it was, in the beginning of the month, it hit, almost 42,000. And we're talking in December, around Christmas time, it was at 22,000. So it went up $20,000 in 2 weeks, this Bitcoin. And wow. So when these cryptocurrencies increase, that's when folks obviously get more bang for the buck. So we accept the cryptocurrencies, and this is all due to, our guy who's behind the scenes, our tech guy, who's wonderful, Sean. He's the best. And that's what I was saying. We couldn't do what we do without the team. And really, you know, this right here, what we're doing here is part of the team. I mean, you know, you're doing this, you're promoting the book, you're not getting anything from it, you know, but you consider it to be something important. And this is part of our whole network. And we all do things for each other, and we don't do it for compensation. We do it because it's the right thing to do. So,
exactly.
Yes. So all of us are part of the team, and the listeners as well. And I know when we get to the last hour that, you know, we're going to have, you know, the calls, and these are great people. I love taking calls, and I love answering questions to the best of my ability. And, I'm looking forward to that. And I'm looking forward to, revealing this one part of the book where Sydney, has John do his dirty work. And I just want to say that there has been over the years criticism, you know, of John, that, hey, he did all this stuff and, you know, he did all this bad stuff and he made a ton of money and now he's coming clean. You know, why didn't he come clean before he did it? Well, that's not the way it works. Right?
No, it isn't.
Yeah. You know, you do these things and, you know, sometimes you don't realize you're doing something bad. Sometimes right. You think you're doing something good, you know, and that's happened to me in life and jobs where I thought I was selling a good product. And then when I realized it wasn't a good product, I immediately quit. And, you know, to the, you know, dismay and, you know, really confusion, of those around me that, you know, saw that, you know, the money was good and I just can't stomach stuff like that. If it's something that's not helping people, then, and it's hurting them, it's actually hurting them, then I immediately disassociate myself from it. And which is why I guess Washington DC is such a turnoff to a lot of people, because these representatives and senators go in there, you know, middle class, and they come out millionaires.
Right.
As public servants. I mean, how is it that, you know, right. They're allowed to do that, right?
Right. A wrestling coach goes to serve the people in a particular area of Illinois. A wrestling coach. And comes back a millionaire?
Right. Right.
Dennis Hastert,
right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And there were other things about good old Dennis.
Oh, yes. Apparently he had some issues.
Yeah.
Eli Lilly, which is a factor here. Keep in mind that the Bush family has had close connections with Eli Lilly. Sat on the board, and some of the things that that George W. Bush did in Texas was that he made Prozac and certain other drugs available to the prisoners, and he had this operation going as a test state, which when you read about all the stuff that they do. The other thing, too, that is very interesting is that people don't realize how they brand these products. Now, this started out as fluoxetine, and they pay a company, Eli Lilly, paid a company that specializes in branding a product. And so when you think about the name Prozac, it just has a ring about it. Pro. It makes it sound like it's a very positive, wonderful thing that everybody must have. And people don't realize that they're being set up by geniuses to accept things because of how it sounds. I don't know how much they paid for the,
Absolutely. No, they pay millions.
Yes.
They literally pay. It's like, let me do it, you know. Let me do it. I'll do it for a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. I'll come up with a name. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, exactly. And most of these drug names are just bizarre. I mean, Prozac is kind of, you know, pedestrian and staid compared to the names nowadays, you know, Cymbalta, you know, all of these weird, you know, sounding names. So yeah, they actually do pay. Companies exist who make millions of dollars from, in this case, Eli Lilly. And I believe they're based in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I guess that's not too far from you.
Right.
Yeah. And New Jersey was a big pharma state as well. It still is. You know, there's a lot. Johnson & Johnson.
Oh,
which
right.
Used,
yes.
Yeah, it used to be a clean. It's funny, you know, all the years that I read the Wall Street Journal, I never read anything about any improprieties regarding Johnson & Johnson's business practices. But nowadays, they're all over the place. So they obviously have fallen off the wagon and decided that profits make much more sense than, you know, being ethical.
Right.
Sadly.
And what they wanted to do was to create a blockbuster.
Yes, that's the term, blockbuster. That's a term that John uses throughout the book, and also another term which isn't used here in the United States as it is in Europe is turnover. You know, we think of a turnover as, you know, a snack that has like apple or cherry in it, but turnover just means sales. You know, and that was the whole goal, was to increase the turnover. And when Sidney approached John, you know, it was with turnover in mind. And John knew, and I'll let his words, you know, when we get to that, I'll let his words describe exactly what happened. And that's perfect timing, because then we'll go to the break and then we will get the callers, right?
Right. Even as early as, the drug came out in 88. But even before that, when they were involved in a lawsuit, it says the court determined that Lilly's cover-up of deaths is standard practice in the industry, and that the official deaths, the deaths that occur during a so-called clinical trial, are industry secrets, as if it were some sort of an ingredient. But those are industry secrets.
Yeah. So, I've never taken any of these type of drugs. Fortunately, I guess I never, you know, was a candidate for them. I know there's people who have certain issues, and I guess this is maybe a last resort or close to a last resort. So,
and initially, it, from what I understand, it makes you feel better because that's what you've been promised, that you would feel better. And so what it does, it dulls your mind to the point that you think that you feel better, and you're hooked, because they are, you're addicted to it. You become addicted.
Yes, and the suicide as well. So.
Right. John says, my fluoxetine doctors were eating out of the palm of my hand. We had only just returned to Sweden when I began to generously hand out the new pills. time for the sewing. My doctors saw to it that as many of their patients as possible enjoyed them. This is how our new drug was launched before it even had been approved.
They laid the groundwork for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they used money and gifts, ultimately money, to swing the doctors over to their side.
Right.
Yeah.
And John, who was also, quite interestingly, he was also a rock star for a period of
yes.
time.
And yes,
then he,
that's right.
Yeah. Then he got into a business where that seemed more legitimate, and he wasn't out. He didn't have groupies or whatever. But he was multi-talented. And he was in charge of salespeople, pharmaceutical drug people.
Yes.
And they would tell him, we just can't get in to see this doctor. And he told them how to manipulate the nurses with flowers, take flowers in, do this, do that, do whatever it takes, and to set things in the waiting rooms, pamphlets on certain drugs, but to manipulate their way into the doctor's office to talk
yes.
to the doctor. Okay, we'll be right back. About 3 minutes until the top of the hour, this Prozac, chapter 7, my Prozac story. He talks about the blockbuster. He talks about the approval process, the serotonin theory, all of these things. Oh, and the side effect. Not only did they say, "Oh, this is good for you for." To make people, depressed people feel normal. They also said, if being, overweight has been a problem, then this is good for weight reduction. Well, a lot of people are overweight, so this was very, very appealing. But the approval process had to do with money. And,
yes.
So go ahead and.
Yes, yes. And it, you know, and that's, you know, money makes the world go around, right? I mean, even, for example, publishing, right? I mean, you have to introduce new books in order to stay alive, or new products in order to stay alive. And
right.
that's just the way it is. So, you know, it makes sense that they have to introduce new products in order to maintain their, you know, competitiveness and their financial viability. And a lot of people depend on, in this case, Eli Lilly, to put bread on their table, and people will unfortunately do things that put finances before people's welfare. And in this case, this is John's explaining in that chapter 7, that he says, unfortunately, as far as the approval in Sweden was concerned, nothing made a difference, and the situation grew more acute. Sidney Torrell, who was then vice president of the European sector, was now the CEO of Lilly. I had been at an internal company seminar in London when he appeared briefly to tell us how important motivation was. And then this, he explains, he was in the car with him. He says, when he found out that I had to get my flight back to Sweden that same day, he offered to take me to the airport. And I willingly agreed. The driver greeted us, held the doors open, and after we had slid across the back seat, gently closed the doors so that you could scarcely hear the click. It was a large car, and the driver appeared to be standing up while sitting down. The motor purred so softly and uniformly that I hardly felt it move away. We left the hotel, which resembled a park in a suburb of London, and hovered to the airport. Torrell did everything to make me feel small. He knew the coolie head only too well. The hearty invitation at the hotel resulted in a journey in which he didn't speak to me, knowing that, appropriate to our respective status, it was up to him to start a conversation. Instead,
yes.
he thumbed through his notes. The sound of his papers was the only conversation. The leather seats were still cold. I wondered whether Toril had seat heating and whether the driver already knew, simply from the manner in which Toril and I had approached the car, that the heating for my seat shouldn't be switched on. Suddenly, the bustle of the airport appeared, planes starting and landing, service trucks and passenger buses were all in view, and Sidney Toril finally broke his silence. "Prozac," he began. I nodded and waited for him to continue. "That subject is very important to me, too," he added just as the car began to slow down and pull into a parking space. I didn't answer and wasn't expected to. I had understood the message. The approval had to progress in Sweden. "Do you understand?" he asked by way of parting as I stood on the tarmac. "Yes, sir," I said, as an obedient schoolboy might sound. But Sidney Toril had already returned to his notes, and the driver had already removed my luggage from the trunk. He gave it to me, shut the car door, and showed me the direction to take. The message was clear. My career now depended upon the rapid approval of fluoxetine in Sweden. Sidney Toril would then be able to market it as Prozac in the United States.
Yikes.
That's it?
Yeah. Okay,
well, that's how they do it, right?
Yep, that's what they do. Wow. And I reread that several times and I thought, wow, population without saying that he didn't have to say a lot. Okay, we'll be right back. Gary, he is he's the publisher, and we're talking about a book, Side Effects, Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider by John Verapin, PhD, and that pressure drive with Sidney Toril, oh my gosh, and it was really up to John to find out how to get approval, and he decided that he had to buy a psychiatrist, and you just have to figure out which one, what the price was, which he was able to do. If you'd like to call into the program with questions or comments, telephone number is 800-313-9443. This was his career because he had to get it approved in Sweden, and then it would be approved in Britain, and then it would be approved in the United States. And what he said, what John said, in the meantime, Toril had arrived again and had formulated his request to push fluoxetine somewhat more clearly. He sounded a bit like the Catholic priest at Sunday school. Do it or else.
Yeah, that's a very important part of this story too, because, you know, when you get to that level, obviously, and you're aware of the dynamics between the, you know, the CEO of a multinational, you know, billion-dollar company and a hustler, a salesman, then, yeah, you really don't have to talk much, obviously. And he let him know right away that, you know, if you want to play in the big leagues, you know, I'm giving you a ride to the airport. You know, you're basically nothing, you know, compared to me.
Right.
You know, and I'm going to let you in to my world. And all you have to do is just figure out how to get this on the market. Basically, as you said, as you read, do what you have to do, period.
Right.
And, or if you don't, And this is the important part of the message. One of the important parts of the message. If you don't, you're basically done. And
right.
So when people, you know, criticize, or people who might want to criticize John, you know, they could say, well, you know what? He got the message, but he didn't know at that point what it was that he had to do. He just figured, okay, I'm going to do it. Because Sidney, good old Sidney, was saying that, you know, if you don't get this done, you're off the team. And when you make that much money, the money that John made for, you know, doing what he did, and a lot of it is, and we've seen it, we've been to doctor's offices where, you know, the drug rep comes in and, you know, they've got their bag of tricks and they're waiting to see the doctor and they've got the goodies for the receptionists and, well, of course, there's other things that John talks about with the receptionists as well. It wasn't just, you know, going in to see them with a bag of goodies. It was more than that. And I don't want to spoil it for people because there are, again, more people who are getting the book. And I can see that crossing across the computer screen here. And they'll see what John actually did in order to advance the company and his interests. And which, of course, he later came to regret.
Yes. And it was so incredible. He had children with his first wife. He ultimately married a third time when he was quite a bit older. And he never really looked his age. He looked great right up to the end.
You're right.
The reason that it was his child. He said, I'm scared that my son will also be turned into the type of person that the pharmaceutical industry loves the most. A willing pill popper who takes medicines for made-up illnesses people are talked into having, with deadly side effects included in the price. The pharmaceutical industry is changing the reasoning of the coming generation. He did it for his son.
Yes, and that was in, as we know, that was in the beginning stages of all this. Now it's a well-oiled machine to the point where the pharmaceutical industry is using the media, the government, in order to get their message out. And they are really, sitting back because, it costs them millions and millions of dollars, of course, but they're sitting back and they're reaping the rewards of having the government and the media shill for them. You know, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're shilling for them. They're shaming people who have doubts about the vaccine. And it's gotten to such a more sophisticated level than it was when John was doing it. That's why, and we touched on this before, that's what's important about the book, is that you can see that this is the beginning of what we're dealing with now. And the thought that, wow, how is it that they are, you know, doing this in lockstep, and they're all agreeing, they're saying the same things, the new normal, you've seen those videos, right? Because of what John has laid out, they've gotten to the point where they just spend so much money, and it's just so effective now to buy this mass obedience from the media, from government, from the health authorities, that they know exactly what they're doing.
Exactly. He said, at the beginning of chapter 16, you could exaggerate and say that pharmaceutical companies consist of two departments, legal and marketing. Researchers and research results are bought as required, but the marketing has to work. The lawyers subtly sweep away any breaches of law, broken porcelain, or unpleasant trails of blood with their brooms and sweep up the mess. And that's exactly what they do.
That's right. And he says it so well.
He does. Gosh.
Yeah. I didn't write that. So,
you know, he did.
That was him. And, you know, a guy who, you know, English was not, you know, his first language, and who was, as you said, you know, the one of many siblings that he had. He was of seven, coming for, you know, for the hope of a better world. And here's a guy who went to the top and said, you know what, I can still make money, but I'm not interested in it. I'm interested in teaching people about the downside to all of these drugs.
Right. Some of the ways that they buy doctors. Oh my goodness. He actually only ran into one doctor that said, I know what you're doing. And, you know, I'll go along with your, I'll go on your little trip to the Caribbean. But I'm not going to buy into what you're trying to sell me. Only one doctor out of hundreds that took advantage of the opportunity that Eli Lilly was giving them. Oh, come and spend a week on a Caribbean isle. And they also,
what does that have to do with medicine?
Right. And they provided all sorts of entertainment, and you could bring your wife or not bring your wife. It was interesting.
And guess what? It's all a tax write-off too.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
They got it made, man. They know how to do it. And it's really not that hard to buy off a politician. It really doesn't cost that much. People think that, you know, it's something that, you know, it's cost prohibitive. I mean, to these guys, $100,000 is like $5 to us.
Right.
So, yeah, it's kind of, you know, expected that this country, which is centered around money, would, you know, devolve to the status that it has. You know, because money is, especially with Citizens United, there's no restrictions on that because they consider it free speech to be able to donate money. It's the same as, you know, the First Amendment. You know, you have a right, you have the freedom to take your money and use it as a way to, you know, show what you think, what you feel, and that's free speech. So we're probably not going to get out of this money thing for a while. And besides, it's making those in D.C. fabulously wealthy.
Exactly.
So it's all tied into this pharmaceutical nightmare that we find ourselves in. And, you know, it's going to get to the point where, of course, you saw, Deanna, that there was one of the congressmen who said that he's willing to authorize a higher payout for the stimulus
if poor people get
the vaccine, right?
Yes.
He'll do the 1400, but you gotta get jabbed. Be a good boy or girl and get jabbed first, and we'll give you more money.
And you wreck their business, get them fired from their jobs, and then you put that on them.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah,
we have a caller, Mark in Philly. Mark?
Hello, Deanna.
Hi.
Hello to your guest there. Deanna, it's been a while since I've listened to your show, but something today said, listen to Deanna. And here we go. This is the perfect subject because I've called him before about this kind of thing, but I'm glad that your guest is, he's also wrote about the Liberty, right? You wrote about the Liberty?
That's right. It never ends, actually, the Liberty story for me. It's actually coming to an end, but yeah, there's a revision to the book coming out, and what I have uncovered is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I believe I've spoken with you before, and I forgot your name. I'm sorry. I'm just
Dave Gehare.
Dave Gehare, yes, and I'm Mark, and I'm here in Philly, and I happen to be a Navy veteran, and I've called in to Deanna when she talked about the drug issue, and I'm telling you, I have firsthand experience. The largest healthcare provider in the United States, in case your listeners don't know, is the VA administration. And I happen to be a veteran, and I went through experiences with the VA and firsthand experience of these SSRIs. And I trusted that they, you know, that they knew what they were doing, and that they were intelligent, and that they, here's the key part, that they cared. But what I've learned in my synopsis of psychiatry is that they're drug dealers, illegalized drug dealers, and they don't give a damn. Most of them don't give a damn about human life. And I think many of them are actually, we have empathy and compassion on the one extreme. On the other hand, on all the way at the other end of the scale, you have apathy. You have narcissism. And many psychiatrists are narcissists. They think they're God and you're nothing, and they're going to tell you this and that and whatever, and they don't listen. So I happen to have, prescribed me SSRIs for depression. Now it turned out after multiple facilities that I went to try to heal the depression from basically post-traumatic stress disorder that I got triggered in when I was in service. It turned out that the SSRIs, I found out later, I stopped taking them. I stopped going to the VA system altogether because they were causing me so many side effects. They were causing me extreme side effects the same symptoms they were supposed to solve. They were causing them. And the reason why, for me, I discovered later that, I'm a poor metabolizer. Now I'm not. And what that means is I lack a certain enzyme in my body where I can't even process the darn drugs, and the SSRIs would build up toxicity in my body, and they could have killed me. They could have killed me, for real. I'm not alone. I'm not rare. Approximately 10% of Caucasians are poor metabolizers. Approximately 10%. And all you have to do is research, and I did this at University of Pennsylvania. I got access to the library system, and I went into their on their database, and it accessed PubMed. And PubMed, I just typed in my enzyme CYP2D6, and it came up with 588 articles. This is in 2017 that I did this, and I was really blown away with it. Especially the best research came from Sweden, and from back in the mid 90s. And what basically boil it down, what they said is poor metabolizers should not be prescribed SSRIs because it can cause death by toxicity. Death by toxicity. And I'm like, oh, my God. And then the other part that I read, that I researched there, was that there are other metabolizers called ultra-metabolizers. And they process the drug really, really good to the other extreme, and it's so good that it can drive them over the edge. 4%, approximately 4% of Caucasians are ultra-metabolizers. And the synopsis of that is, ultra-metabolizers should not be prescribed SSRIs because it can cause death by suicidality. Wow. And right then, I was like, oh, my God. You know, so you add up 10% plus 4%, you got 14%. That's 1 out of 7. And then right at that time was when Trump was on the news with Dr. Shulkin, who happened to be a professor from University of Pennsylvania. And I said, I've got to print this out. I printed out 8 of the articles. I highlighted them, and I set up an appointment. I was not going to the VA at the time at all, but I set up an appointment with one of the higher, longer-serving psychiatrists, put it in front of him on his desk, and had a conversation with him, told him, look, I was put at the edge of death with this stuff. And so, and surely the VA is doing something about this. No, they weren't doing anything about it, and they weren't going to do anything about it, and the psychiatrist would not even take a closer look at the information I had put in front of him, because he said, well, this is a new phenomenon. I said, really? And I had articles in front of him in 1998, 2002, 2004, 2006. I mean, you know, so it's, the pharmaceutical companies know this too, and you're correct, and some of the, most of the pharmaceuticals are around the Princeton, New Jersey area. One of them's, I mean, and these facilities are like small cities in and of themselves. They have their own power plants. They have their, I mean, they're huge facilities. So there's a whole lot of money in the drug business for darn sure. And, and the SSRIs were developed like what you guys are talking about because I went down the rabbit hole. Bush Senior's was on the board of Eli Lilly. Rumsfeld was on the board of, I think, Searle, S-E-A-R-L-E, which is the
yes,
one that developed aspartame.
Yes.
And I think Rumsfeld, or, Cheney was on a board of one of the others, I think, and it's interesting that Bush Senior was a veteran himself, and what happened with the whole, Gulf War One and beyond. And don't think that he didn't have an influence on getting these drugs, these SSRIs into the coffers of the VA system, because he surely did, I guarantee it. So it's,
he did that with the vaccine schedule for children, because this was one of the beautiful articles in the Wall Street Journal. You can always tell that if it's an important one, it's buried in the back. And there was an article buried in the back about Bush being ordered by Big Pharma, of course they didn't use that word, to increase the vaccine schedule of school-age children. Back then in the late 80s, only about 30-35% of school-age children were vaccinated. They ordered him to bring it up to 90%, and he did his job. So this is a real evil guy who has been responsible for a lot of misery in our world.
We are going to break, gentlemen. Mark, feel free to stay over the break. We'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes.
All right, welcome back. This is Deanna, and we have Mark and Philly that's talking about his experience with the VA. And when you look at, the government, the U.S. government, is the biggest consumer of drugs. Because they have jurisdiction over the prisons, they have jurisdiction over the schools, they have jurisdiction over the military, and you were talking about the vaccine schedule, which Congress changed in 1986, which took away all liability from the drug manufacturers, and they were able to increase the number of vaccines, excuse me, to what we now have is about 72 different vaccines. And seriously, are there actually 72 diseases that you live in fear of getting? So, Mark, do you have some other information you'd like to share?
Sure. What I like to say is that, my mindset back then, which was during the late 80s into the 90s, into 2002, I wasn't looking for fault. I thought, well, my body's just having trouble adjusting. Well, yeah, it was. But nobody in that process, multiple psychiatrists at multiple VA facilities, never took the time to research what was going on. They did notice that this was different, and it's like, well, they didn't know what was happening, but all they would do is just say, well, they throw me another drug, so to speak. Okay. It had a different name, but it happened to be the same kind of drug. And here I was a layperson. I didn't know that. I trusted that they were really trying to help me. But
sure.
I learned since they were not trying to help me.
When you go to a psychiatrist, they see you for between 5 and 7 minutes. If you engage in talk therapy, the doctor has to spend an hour with you. So it's about money as well as not caring about what they're doing to people.
Yeah, what I needed for the PTSD was primarily counseling. I didn't want the drugs, but the way the hierarchy is set up in the VA system and maybe throughout is that the hierarchy at the top of the pyramid is, are the psychiatrists, not psychologists, psychiatrists.
Right.
So, and back when, you know, in the '80s and in the '90s and beyond, and if you needed counseling, which is what I needed, they would give you very little counseling, but they made sure to give you a drug. Right. Mm-hmm. And, now the other thing that happened when I, you know, I stopped going to the VA in 2002, but in 2017, I re-embraced it because I needed counseling. And I went to a third party to get counseling that didn't bridge the gap back to be going to the VA for counseling, still for PTSD, which I'm still trying to get actually. But I'm not with the understanding, I'm not taking your drugs. I'm not taking any of your drugs because I was, because I discovered they put me at the risk of death with drugs. I'm not taking their drugs. But here's the other thing. I did look into the, you know, the possibility of suing them for medical malpractice. However, because of tort reform, if it didn't happen in the last 2 years, it didn't happen.
Mm.
So I couldn't go back on what had happened before where they put me at the risk of death for real.
Wow.
And so I don't, they don't care. So my other understanding about SSRIs is the core of it, I think also for those who aren't poor metabolizers or ultra metabolizers is what it does is it interrupts REM sleep.
Right.
When we interrupt REM, we don't get a deep, soulful, I say soulful, sleep where we tap into the dream time of our being and our connection with soul, our connection with all of life, you know, the spiritual aspect of our being. Because these devils and their agents, their agents and their shill front men who are drug dealing sons of guns, if you ask me, they don't care about soul. They could care less. They're in it for the money, and there's a whole lot of money there, and they're making a whole lot of money. And now they got people next to worshiping the medical establishment. I mean, and so what's come up to me recently about this vaccine stuff is there is the analogy of the velvet hand, the iron fist in the velvet glove,
mm-hmm.
the iron fist in the velvet glove. Well, I say that this is the iron fist in the latex glove. This is the iron fist in the latex glove. So these vaccines that are coming out with, they're not, my sense of it is that it will compromise our immune systems and it will warp our DNA. It will rearrange, it will reprogram our DNA somehow. This is advanced stuff, but this is about taking us out of connecting with our souls. So, you know, as they say, the devil's in the details. In the detail of these vaccines, the devil is definitely in the detail of these vaccines. That's what I got to say. So thank you for being here, Deanna, and having your guest on. And I would like to be able to connect with you. I could leave my number with the board man and,
okay.
and have him contact me because I've talked with you before. I know about the Liberty and that issue,
yeah.
With that. And by the way, that Liberty connected a lot of dots for me about who the enemy really is and who they're connected to. And it's in our face now. And they're like, na-na-na-na-na-na. They're gonna bring on this evil stuff regardless.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Right.
Thank you so much, Mark. Take care. Really take care. Be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we.
All righty, we are back. Excuse me. Our guest is Dave Gaheri, and thank you, Mark, for calling in. And now we have Mike in Kentucky. Did you want to say anything about Mark's phone call before we move on to Mike?
Yeah, I just feel bad that, you know, for what he has had to go through with the VA. It's always sad to hear when people have to suffer. So it just makes me sad.
Indeed. I feel the same way. Alrighty, Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Great, great. I wasn't sure if I was on or not. There's usually a little burst of static. got some quotes here, but what did you say you had a book you were working on, the second edition or update?
You mean on the Liberty?
Yeah, the USS Liberty.
Yes. It's in its second version, but there's going to be, and I say hopefully, but maybe I shouldn't, but there's going to be another version coming out because of information that was uncovered. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Well, there used to be a show on here that talked about it, and the guys quit to produce a film, and I never did hear what happened with the documentary.
Yeah, that was us. We did the USS Liberty Massacre Hour, and because that's what it was. It was a massacre.
One way to put it, yeah.
Yeah. And
on the GD ship on the bottom. I'm not going to war over a bunch of dead sailors and some other choice quotes from...
That's part of the mythology of the Liberty story.
Okay.
That didn't occur.
Okay. Well,
there's a lot of mythology.
Okay.
With the Liberty story, but I was...
There were not two sorties recalled? They tried to send rescue planes or something?
That happened. That happened.
Okay.
And there's a reason that it happened. So...
okay.
You know, the story is much more nuanced and detailed than.
So LBJ himself did not order those planes recalled.
What's that?
LBJ himself did not order those planes recalled.
No, he did. He did. He ordered the second batch, the second group that was scrambled recalled.
And they were unmarked.
Because they didn't want to. Or the officers there aboard the carrier didn't want to believe that McNamara was correct in turning them around again, and they wanted confirmation from a higher authority. Of course, from the Secretary of Defense, the next higher authority is the President.
Well, of course, McNamara, I'm thinking some of the insiders at that time might have known not to trust him over the what was that, the torpedo attack? I can't remember what it's called. He admitted in his, memoir, supposedly, that was basically, amplified hoax. It started in Vietnam.
Tonkin?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It wasn't, I don't know if that came into play because, that happened just, Liberty happened in 67 and Tonkin was 64, I think.
Right.
So, but you get the impression that, you know, these guys talk at that level, that 3-star, 4-star level. That's why they're spying on them. You know, they want to make sure they're not comparing notes and going, wait a minute, this is a hoax. This is a sham, you know. But, yeah, they're spying on all those guys at the 3-star, 4-star levels, probably before the Patriot Act, but, They've automated a lot of the spying now, so, you know, a lot of the stuff is leaked out from the different whistleblowers, and I think Snowden saw that, the people in those circles talk about, you know, stuff like that, and they see how these whistleblowers are treated, so, or Snowden didn't have any whistleblower protection, but the quotes I wanted to read for you, in reference to that last caller, Alan Francis, psychiatrist and former Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Version 4 Task Force Chairman, says, quote, there are no objective tests in psychiatry, no x-ray, laboratory, or exam finding that says definitively that someone does or does not have a mental disorder. It's bull bleep. Actually, you know, expletive deleted. I mean, you just can't define it. And this is a guy that was on the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Version 4 Task Force Chairman. There's a Citizens Commission for Human Rights, which I know they were created or set up by the Church of Scientology or whatever they are, which I've heard different people that's been in there with and left that actually think there's a lot of mythology about Scientology that is not justified either, but that they had to set it up as a church in order to be able to have these there are camps or operations or something that they were doing they in order to get around the regulations around the medical profession to help people. creative, I guess, but to do that sort of thing.
That there's a separation there, but there's an association.
Yeah, well, you know, you hear about a lot of the Hollywood elite and all that, that it's a big money game at the top, and that's probably true. I mean, to get to reach a state of clear, they spend all this money, you know. But the Citizen Commission for Human Rights has a lot of people in it that aren't Scientologists.
And, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it was started by them, I think they have a lot of valid information. One of the things that they have, if that guy's still listening, it's a veteran, he needs to get their documentary on how the military was instrumental in expanding this, psychotropic drug industry globally to where it's now something crazy like $500 billion. I mean, it's a monster. And so they're suppressing a lot of science, and they just simply treat symptoms with questionable stuff. As he got into, he touched upon that you can have all these problems with metabolism, and it creates immune function problems, and in a lot of ways, it could make the health problems worse that might actually be what's causing depression or mental illness. And these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the SSRIs, that are prescribed to allegedly help with these symptoms, they don't even bother looking. I actually confront it because I've had over the years friends and relatives that end up caught in this system. And I caught one of them, I caught him off their heels, I guess. I said, hey, have you ever tested any of your patients for things like gluten intolerance or toxoplasmosis, you know, because those symptoms can mimic schizophrenia and depression and manic problems. They got really mad and said, what do I look like, a gastroenterologist? And I'm like, geez, a little defensive, aren't you? Because they don't want to look for causes. It would interfere with the profit matrix, you know,
right.
and you're a battery for that matrix. I mean, so they just, you know, like you were saying, they talk to you for a few minutes and write you a script, and then you're gone, and that's money.
Right.
So it's ridiculous that
and they get a lot of kickbacks too.
It took 2 years. CBS 60 Minutes finally did a story on it, and people know that I've talked about this for a long time. Called me up and said, "Hey, did you see 60 Minutes? Did you see 60 Minutes?" I'm like, "No," and they had did a story back in the spring, maybe April, about strippers and free trips. Mm-hmm. And like free meals, the drug salesmen come into the office with catered meals. They come in there and
you need to read Side Effects Deaths, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. It tells you, it fills in all the details that you're talking about.
When that story broke about the strippers and the free trips and stuff, that was probably in 2016. It only took most of 3 years for CBS to finally do a story on it. And it's because
they
CBS
to,
gets
because
all this
of Vera Pinsk.
They get all this money. Well, they
and
get all this money from their advertisers.
Sure.
They're part of the problem.
Okay, we do have some good callers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the liberty questions too. Appreciate it.
Yes. Okay, let's take John in California. John? John, are you with us or no?
Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
Dave. Nice to hear you again. We spoke the last time you hosted. You had that guest from the Liberty Survivor. That was
a great
show.
John. Great to hear you.
Yeah. Just real quick, how's Phil doing? We haven't heard from him in quite a while.
He's doing good. I just talked to him, I think, about 2 days ago. He sounded great.
Well, that's good, yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time since I heard anything from him. But, I'm looking at that first book he put out, and, yeah, the one you're doing, I'll look forward to that again. Quick getting on to questions. I suffered severe depression back in the 80s and 90s, and I probably took a lot of stuff that they talk. I know one was Prozac. I think of them was Zoloft. I know there was other major names. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but I don't, you think about it, how I survived that, but I did. And actually, luckily, from a doctor that, did a diagnosis and said instead, you've got obsessive compulsive disorder in your mind. And she, put me on some quick and did not put me on a lot of drugs real fast. And not long after that, I got over it. It's like a window opened and, you know, hey, it's my life. I got it back again. And I didn't have to go on anything after that. And that was, you know, a lucky thing for me. But and also after that, because I've read the Spotlight newspaper from its beginning and then now American Free Press and all those articles later on about with drugs and people talking about, you know, alternatives and what's really going on with the industry and that, I'm so thankful to get that information, and it just kept me off that stuff for, you know, up to this point that I've been able to do very well. The only downside of that first time I got through that, it cost me my marriage with my first wife. She didn't believe it and argued with a doctor, and then next thing we know, we were split. That was the only downside of that whole thing, getting through it. But it saved my life, I believe.
Or maybe it was an upside.
Yeah, well, maybe so. Another quick one in the Navy. I was in Vietnam, and I happened to be at that time when Admiral Zumwalt, in his tenure as Chief of Naval Operations, he started this program they called the Amnesty Program. And if you were taking drugs, mostly if you're smoking marijuana and or taking any other thing, that you could, you know, go and get counseling and therapy and, you know, get off instead of being put in the brig or something, say like that. I was a representative with my local squadron I was in, and then went to the some of these sessions they had. They had weren't any doctors giving out medications or anything. They had a lot of counseling, and a lot of these private counselors come in off, and they do sessions, therapy, and group counseling. Very interesting, and I think in the long run, I think it just kind of was a gloss over, because a lot of these, some of these service guys was dealing with and that, what they went through, and then they got out. And then I learned later on that they just went right back into drugs, and some of them just overdosed and died right off the bat. Even some of the counselors I dealt with, they were private. They ended up falling off the wagon later on too, and just getting back into their problems they had with drugs. They counseled because they were in it before, so they thought that was a great help. It was an interesting experience to say that. I think that what they did back then. And my brother-in-law, my wife's oldest brother, he was in the Army in the Tet Offensive, and he got Agent Orange. And he came out, and he got the runaround up till, well, today, just about with the VA about getting this and that. And he could have gone to a private doctor and had some of that taken care of for less money. But like I said, that's a bureaucracy with the VA, though. They don't want to perpetuate somebody's job by going to an easier way. But luckily he's been able to survive through it himself. But, you know,
that hurt a lot of people, that Agent Orange.
Yeah, luckily was just on his feet, but still, we don't know. He's had some other maladies. He just had some infection. He had to go back in urinary. And I wasn't surprised they didn't say anything about the Agent Orange. I'm not surprised if that, over all these years, still causes some problems.
Even for the children.
Oh, yeah.
Even for their children.
Yeah. Anyway, He's still plucking along at 78, but,
wow.
They're hitting you with all that stuff, so. Anyway, that book, isn't the AFP, weren't they advertising that book for a while too, Dave?
Yeah, they carried it. Yep. And of course, I was with AFP for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And,
I do miss your writing again. Sorry about that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Anyway, I'll look,
I just don't have the time.
Yeah, I know. There's so many books. Yeah, I look into, now that I've heard more about it, is looking into getting that again. along with your next book on the Liberty. But anyway,
yeah, I think you'll be surprised, pleasantly surprised that, yeah, you know, it's not what we all thought it was. You know, it's a lot different.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, especially listening to that one when you hosted with the survivor.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
And the call he got from the guy, one of the ships that came to help them out, and he didn't know
what about
all those years.
What about that?
You had a caller in who was one of the ships that came to rescue.
That's right.
And he said, oh, remember me? We were helping you get all the paperwork together to get off.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yes. That was John Conroy. John was on the USS Davis, and he was a personnelman. And John and I are in contact regularly. He's a great guy, and I introduced him to the fellow off the Liberty who assisted him, and they never realized who they were after all these years, and I hooked them up together on a phone call, and hopefully they'll meet soon, because this year the reunion is in Pensacola, and it was the same last year, but because of COVID, it took it out.
Well, that's good. They could still have a way to get together.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dave, thanks a lot for all your good work.
Thank you, John.
Indiana. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, let's take Ken in New York.
Hi, Deanna. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Ken.
Before I ask my question, could you just give out where we can get the DVD for the Liberty?
Well, the DVD of the Liberty is not ready yet. What happened?
I thought
was
I missed something.
Yeah, the DVD we were talking about before was a different DVD. That was The Greatest Story Never Told about World War II and Adolf Hitler. But the Liberty, what happened was that when the first book was released, people came forward to give their story, and the same thing happened when the second version came out, and that led me down a path to dig out more information. So as soon as this book is done before the 54th observance of the massacre, then we'll revise the script and get moving on that.
Okay. Are you aware of the, pervasiveness of fluoride, even in antibiotics? The most notable ones that I've had some experience with, fortunately, and then stopped it, was levoquinone and Cipro. They changed the name slightly. They call it fluoroquinones. I can't imagine why a fluoride would be put into a antibiotic. And on top of that, they caused a lot of damage.
That's the reason.
Now, yes. And I went to one of my doctors tried to prescribe it for me one time. It was a foot doctor. And I told him I didn't want these still. Now, the next time I go into the doctor's office, I see you have an allergy. I said, no, I don't. They're being sued into next week. I said, they're causing all kinds of damage. And that's how that's what happens on your medical record. When they call your medical record up, apparently they can only put in that you have an allergy to it.
Wow. Well, they have an algorithm that they look at, and you can only choose certain things.
Mm. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it is very interesting that, and you can get a medical bracelet that lists all of your allergies, which I think is very good. It's a very good little investment.
Yes.
Because one of the things that they are suggesting about this COVID vaccine is that if you have allergies to something, that you shouldn't take it.
Yeah. Yeah, they better get that message over to the talking heads on CNN.
I don't think that I don't think they're going to make any big announcements on that. Yeah. Wow. And there's other things too that you can do to protect yourself. Let's see, let's take, we have a caller, Tom, in Utah. Tom?
Hello. Just a little side note. I was asked to go down to New Orleans after Katrina and help them identify the cause of death that those families were suffering when they were put into the FEMA trailers. And curiously, they were being told that they were suffering from PTSD or, you know, psychological rather than being, you know, biologically evaluated. So when you get a chance, I know you only got a few seconds to discuss this thing at all, but go to gassingamerica.com and give me a call. And I can take you through the experience that I had where I was just really frustrated with the medical that were brought in, federally provided medical after Katrina. They were telling these people that they were suffering illness and death because of stress. And of course,
didn't Barbara Bush say, oh, those people, they should consider themselves lucky that, that they were given a place to live, and, she was, being very elitist, and, it was pretty terrible. It was very revealing about how they felt about these victims. And when you look at Katrina to begin with, and the dams, that all of a sudden failed, that, kind of created the floods, it's pretty bad. We have no idea what is going on most of the time. We're victimized in so many ways. But we cannot continue to have this victim card and to be a victim. We've got to stand up and become fighters. Quit being victims. Take control of your lives.
That's right.
By the way, those condemned units were then being offered to the Veterans Administration to house the lower income or the homeless vets.
Oh my gosh.
And the people in D.C. were not happy with me when I interfered with that process.
Well, good for you, Tom.
Anyway, when you get a chance, go to gassingamerica.com. It's rather, carefully written so that it doesn't condemn people, but if you see the issue, and then you realize that these people are being injured and they're not being told the truth, and instead they're being given the fenfluroxetine, right?
Yeah.
And telling them even their babies are suffering from PTSD.
Yes.
You know, Jesse Finneran, the ex-deputy sheriff down there in New Orleans, when he called me, he said, they're trying to say that our babies are suffering from stress. And I said, well, how often is a baby sitting in his crib saying, oh, I'm terrified, the dike's going to break? And so, you know, they were trying to say that.
That is such a crime against infants. To put babies, seriously, a baby stressed out? Oh, that just makes me sick that people would, that parents would believe this garbage. Okay, we're out of time. Dave, thank you so much. Tom and the rest of the callers.
Thank you, Deanna.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.
All you do. And you'll be taking the program next week because
I'll be taking the reins.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you for that. Oh, bless your heart. Okay. Take care. Bye bye.